This is becoming the everlasting class here. We are up to death as a transitional stage, loss of loved ones, something about perceptions of the spiritual world from this life. We have ahead of us passage to the next life, the moment of death, the soul's account for its actions, God's mercy and God's justice. Some interesting subjects there. And then there's the nature of the invisible realm, which is over all of our heads, but we'll read what we can about it. Tonight we start with the attitude that we should have when we suffer the loss of our loved ones. First of all, from the Kitab-i-Aqdas itself, we read, "Lament not in your hours of trial, neither rejoice therein. Seek ye the middle way, which is the remembrance of me in your afflictions, and reflections over that which may befall you in future. Thus informeth you he who is the omniscient, he who is aware." The middle way. Neither great sorrow nor rejoicing. To a woman who has just lost her husband, Abdu'l-Bahá writes in a tablet, "Be not grieved at the death of thy respected husband. He hath verily attained the meeting of his Lord at the seat of truth in the presence of the potent King. Do not suppose that thou hast lost him. The veil shall be lifted, and thou shalt behold his face, illumined in the supreme concourse. Just as God the Exalted hath said, him will we surely quicken to a happy life." This is a promise evidently from the Quran. There's no footnote to it. And then he says, "Supreme importance should be attached, therefore, not to this first creation, but rather to the future life." A similar tablet written at the loss of a son. "O thou beloved maidservant of God, although the loss of a son is indeed heartbreaking and beyond the limits of human endurance, yet one who knoweth and understandeth is assured that the son hath not been lost, but rather hath stepped from this world into another, and she will find him in the divine realm. That reunion shall be for eternity, while in this world separation is inevitable and bringeth with it a burning grief. Praise be unto God that thou hast faith, art turning thy face toward the everlasting kingdom, and believest in the existence of a heavenly world. Therefore be thou not disconsolate, do not languish, do not sigh, neither wail nor weep. For agitation and mourning deeply affect his soul in the divine realm." This is an important principle. It's not mentioned too many places. Agitation and mourning deeply affect his soul in the divine realm. "That beloved child addresseth thee from the hidden world." Now here's Abdu'l-Bahá, the supreme consolation. He actually interprets the feelings of the son towards the mother. And he quotes it. You find Shoghi Effendi doing this in the Persian messages a lot. Several places where he says, Abdu'l-Bahá at this moment is looking upon the friends and he is saying, quote, and then he quotes Abdu'l-Bahá from the divine world. He does it with Baha'u'llah in a few places too. "That beloved child addresseth thee from the hidden world. O thou kind mother, Thank divine providence that I've been freed from a small and gloomy cage, and like the birds of the meadows have soared to the divine world, a world which is spacious, illumined, and ever gay and jubilant. Therefore lament not, O Mother, and be not grieved. I am not of the lost, nor have I been obliterated and destroyed. I have shaken off the mortal form and have raised my banner in this spiritual world. Following this separation is everlasting companionship. Thou shalt find me in the heaven of the Lord, immersed in an ocean of light. Sure. Not that I know of, except moderation. Again, you know, he says, what's he said here, it's natural. I mean, this obviously, this is... heartbreaking and beyond the limits of human endurance to lose, for instance, a child. But at the same time, one has to make efforts to pray to overcome the grief, you know. You go with it, you're not suppressing it, but you don't play it out. I think this is what I understand. I mean, there are some cultures where it's required to play it out, where you must grieve and show your grief publicly over and over again. If you don't, immediately people start tongue wagging and saying, look at this, it's just 2 weeks, the husband died, now she's happy in the street, what's this? They don't let anybody come out of a period of mourning, you know. But Baha'u'llah, I think, is moving us to a balance in that. Naturally, we'll have, I think, Baha'is that have lost loved ones and have this consolation, have the feeling for it, they will grieve, but they won't grieve prolonged grief. You know, they'll have their time and then they'll content themselves. I mean, they'll resign themselves to the will of God. After all, it is the will of God. Even if it's an accidental death, it's still within the possibilities and intention of God's will. So one finally has to come to grips with it. But naturally, the loss, the personal loss, the shock, that's there. It's not to be hidden away, but at the same time, one wants to be poised and calm and resigned to God's will. I think this is the balance, you know. So that there's not this urging or pushing to emotional display of grief for the sake of others. And I think some of the martyrs' wives, you know, they were most extraordinary. They had this kind of confirmation so that they could... Actually, they said, my husband has told me that we should have a party. And we're having a party because that's what he wanted. And then they would be... She says, no one should grieve. They should be rejoice in this victory for his soul, for the... And the people, you know, it's hard to understand. And yet that's so inspiring in another way because you know the grief is still there at some level. And how can they overcome that? If it's not with divine assistance, then you realize that this is some special blessing that's come to relieve the people of that immediate grief. But the loss is still there because it's the nature of this world. Maybe somebody else has had experiences when someone else like to comment on this. Okay? Have a few more questions, please. Yes. Well, as Baha'is, we should also be sensitive to the period of grief and mourning. Any consolation would be part of what we're expected to do, instead of lecturing people at that moment to be cheerful. Interesting. Any other comments? O ye two patient souls. This is from Abdu'l-Baha. Your letter was received. The death of that beloved youth and his separation from you have caused the utmost sorrow and grief. For he winged his flight in the flower of his age and the bloom of his youth to the heavenly nest. But he hath been freed from this sorrow-stricken shelter and hath turned his face toward the everlasting nest of the kingdom, and being delivered from a dark and narrow world, hath hastened to the sanctified realm of light. Therein lieth the consolation of our hearts. The inscrutable divine wisdom underlieth such heart-rending occurrences. It is as if a kind gardener transferreth a fresh and tender shrub from a confined place to a wide open area. This transfer is not the cause of the withering, the lessening, or the destruction of that shrub. Nay, on the contrary, it maketh it to grow and thrive, acquire freshness and delicacy, become green and bear fruit. This hidden secret is well known to the gardener. But those souls who are unaware of this bounty suppose that the gardener, in his anger and wrath, hath uprooted the shrub. Yet to those who are aware, this concealed fact is manifest, and this predestined decree is considered a bounty. Do not feel grieved or disconsolate, therefore, at the ascension of that bird of faithfulness. Nay, under all circumstances, pray for that youth, supplicating for him forgiveness and the elevation of his station. I hope that ye will attain the utmost patience, composure, and resignation, and I entreat and implore at the threshold of oneness, begging for forgiveness and pardon. My hope from the infinite bounties of God is that he may shelter this dove of the garden of faith and cause him to abide on the branch of the Supreme Concourse, that he may sing in the best of melodies the praise and glorification of the Lord of names and attributes. All these tablets that I'm reading are from selections from the writings of Abdu'l-Baha. There's a section in the book, really, which deals with these, the question of immortality. They're all Abdu'l-Baha that I've read so far. Yes, this is translated by the Guardian of Selections from the Writings of Abdu'l-Baha. Page 201 is about the son that has been lost and addressing from the other world. And again, O thou seeker of the kingdom, thy letter was received. Thou hast written of the severe calamity that hath befallen thee, the death of thy respected husband. That honorable man hath been so subjected to the stress and strain of this world that his greatest wish was for deliverance from it. Such is this mortal abode, a storehouse of afflictions and suffering. It is ignorance that binds man to it, for no comfort can be secured by any soul in this world, from monarch down to the most humble commoner. If once this life should offer a man a sweet cup, 100 bitter ones will follow. Such is the condition of this world. The wise man, therefore, doth not attach himself to this mortal life and doth not depend upon it. At some moments even, he eagerly wisheth for death, that he may thereby be freed from these sorrows and afflictions. Thus it is seen from some, that some, under extreme pressure of anguish, have committed suicide. As to thy husband, rest assured, this was the case of the husband having committed suicide. As to thy husband, rest assured, he will be immersed in the ocean of pardon and forgiveness, and will become the recipient of bounty and favor. Strive thine utmost to give his child a Baha'i training, so that when he attaineth maturity, he may be merciful, illumined, and heavenly. Be not sorrowful on account of the departure of thy good son. He hath indeed departed from this narrow and gloomy world, which is darkened by unlimited sorrow, unto the kingdom which is spacious, illumined, joyous, and beautiful. God delivered him from this dark well and promoted him unto that supreme height. He gave him wings whereby he soared to the heaven of happiness. Verily, this is the great mercy from him who is precious and forgiving. These are really just a sampling of, as you can imagine, how many Baha'is wrote Abdul Baha about the death of their loved ones. Do not grieve on account of the death of thy son, neither sigh nor lament. That nightingale soared up to the divine rose garden. That drop returned to the most great ocean of truth. That foreigner hastened to his native abode. That ill one found salvation and eternal life. Why shouldst thou be sad and heartbroken? This separation is temporal. This remoteness and sorrow is counted only by days. Thou shalt find him in the kingdom of God, and thou wilt attain to the everlasting reunion. Physical companionship is ephemeral, but heavenly association is eternal. Whenever thou rememberest the eternal and never-ending union, then thou wilt be comforted and blissful. Again, be not grieved at the death of thy dear daughter. That divine bird flew away to the rose garden of the merciful, and that plant of humanity hastened to the garden of the kingdom of El Abha. That drop returned to the most great sea, and that ray betook herself to the most great orb. Be happy and thankful, because thou wilt see her face shining in the divine kingdom, and will find her as a lamp amid an assembly in the spiritual heaven. These are very specific to these people, but also they reveal certain facts about the nature of the next world in a very specific way. And then we have others that talk in general about how that world is so much better than this world, just generally, that unless people are wicked or something particular, they have to have a time of gradually becoming illumined. This is very similar to the condition of this. I think if we checked on the investigation of this, you'd find, for instance, the son, he speaks about that son and he prays for his forgiveness and pardon and so on. Obviously, probably was like a lot of people's children, you know, it's an ordinary kid who got in trouble or something. Who knows what happened? You can't tell the circumstances, but there's enough of them, and they all have the same tone that you think, well, either all these were saints, and that was the only ones he wrote to, or they were people, you know, of similar character to the rest of us. Be not grieved at the death of that infant child, for it is placed in trust for thee before thy Lord in his great kingdom. When you think of the number of children that die and go to the other world, and what the provisions must be for them there, and the fact that just a momentary connection here, just conception shortly after, how many children are lost before they're born? How many children are lost without the people who have conceived them even knowing that they have been conceived? There must be all kinds of provision for this. It makes me think that surely the majority of souls go before birth, and at least before growing up the way we have. So we must be a very select group. I don't know whether we're not supposed to go so soon or what our special qualifications are, but it seems that we're the exception rather than the rule when you think of it. I know they've got some figures now, especially latter half of this century now, just with the legalization of abortion in so many countries. I remember when we left Argentina in the early 70s, they were saying that 60% of all children conceived in the capital were aborted. It's pretty high rate, and I think it just runs like that or higher in most of the European countries too. Mrs. So-and-so, we don't have her name, hastened from this mortal world to the divine world and soared from this temporal realm to the expanse of the kingdom. She abandoned the earthly cage and flew toward the bower of the upper world, so that like unto a nightingale of significances, she may in that divine rose garden engage in praising, glorifying, and sanctifying the true one with the most marvelous melody. Consequently, do ye not sigh in grief because of her decease, and be not dejected on account of her ascension. Now this, reading these tablets over and over, it gradually changes your attitude towards this thing, you know, completely. We've never had pictures from the prophets and others of such a clear nature as to the character of life after death, or to the activities in the other world. Just little hints like this, if you start collecting them. She's in this garden so that she can engage in praising, glorifying, and sanctifying the true one with the most marvelous melody. This is a tablet to someone who'd lost their daughter. In this great catastrophe, the eyes are weeping and the hearts are burning. Because that incomparable plant was growing and developing with infinite joy and fragrance in the garden of the love of God, she was stirred into cheerfulness by the wafting of the breeze of providence. Day by day she was progressing, and she was at all times the cause of the consolation of the hearts of the friends. I will never forget her, for she was one of the most important personages. But it was destined that she might become free from this material world, the world of physical sufferings and tribulations, and hasten toward the heavenly universe, so that through the showers of the cloud of grace she may obtain the utmost freshness, an infinite delicacy, and yield luscious fruits. Consequently, be thou not unhappy, nor be grieved, for she is not counted among the dead. Nay, rather, she was dead. She became alive. She was evanescent. She became eternal. She was earthly. She became heavenly. She lived in the material world. She became wholly spiritual. Like unto a bird, she was a prisoner and captive in the cage of this body. This cage was broken. That bird winged its way heavenward, and in the celestial rose garden she became the associate and companion of other divine birds. Thou shalt find her in that rose garden with the utmost joy and fragrance. One of the friends was visiting with the master in the Holy Land, and of course Abdu'l Baha was always talking about teaching, encouraging so much. Over 50% of the tablets are related to encouraging the friends to teach the cause. And we all have to be involved in inspiring each other and encouraging each other to do that, because the change and progress of the world is much dependent on the diffusion of the faith. And this person asked Abdu'l Baha about teaching the faith. How could they teach the faith more effectively? And Abdu'l Baha responded, it's not exact words, but the idea of what he said, saying that if you want to teach the faith, you must live the life. We've heard this question of living the life, living the Baha'i life, because if we live the Baha'i life, that will effectively attract and confirm the soul. But he said, in order to live the Baha'i life so that one can teach the faith, he said that the soul must, our souls, must acquire thirst for spirituality. You're not going to be able to live the life unless you have thirst for spirituality. Then he said, now how are we going to acquire this thirst for spirituality? And he said, you should study the tablets and the holy books with regard to the subject of immortality. If you read about the life to come, the world to come, about immortality, this will awaken in you a great thirst for spirituality. That will enable you, in turn, to live the life. And then you will teach the cause effectively. Now you see how this course and this subject, what it does to us. We sit and we listen to what the nature of the world is, what the nature of that world is. And we get attracted. We think, my, I really have to pay more attention to this. You know, I mean, this world is going to pass us all by. Everybody's dropping away. If we could see just, you know, like you see, there's slow motion movies and then there's fast movies. Well, in the beginning of your life, life is kind of slow motion, you know. Everything seems to be going along fine. Then it speeds up and people are dropping off and dying and everybody's moving out and you're the only one left. Or well, so you suddenly realize, you know, well, I wish I could catch the train, or I better prepare myself for the journey. So all of that happens. Abdu'l Bahá says that if we meditate about it, think about it a little bit, we'll be able to teach the faith much more effectively. Of course, that means we're going to be detached from the world and attracted and attached to the kingdom. Then we will embody the qualities of the kingdom even while we're in this life. In fact, we will become dwellers of the supreme paradise, he promises, while we're still walking on the face of the earth. Because if the soul is illumined with the light of its Lord, then it's in that heavenly condition even if it's in this life. Referring to the contents of a letter that the Master received, he says, this has occasioned infinite grief, for it spoke of the ascension of that illumined youth. Indeed, in the rose garden of God, that young man was like unto a shrub in its utmost freshness and promising good fruits. Whoever has seen him or heard him has undoubtedly been shocked and grieved at the news of his passing away. However, although that peerless shrub has sought separation from the woods of the nether world, yet it has appeared fully adorned and resplendent in the rose garden of the world on high, in the Abha paradise. That divine bird has flown away from this mortal earthly nest, has ascended to the kingdom of God, and has been engaged in singing the sweet melodies of praise and thanksgiving on the lordly branches in the rose garden of the merciful. Happy is he, and blessed is his abode. He has reaped the result of life, and has become a fruitful tree. Grieve not, therefore, for his death, and be not depressed. These are the same tone, not to wail, not to cry, for that heavenly bird has flown to the infinite realm. Verily, Mr. So-and-so has attained to the meeting of his Lord in the kingdom of Abha, and he is saying, quote, I wish my people knew how my Lord has forgiven me and made me the sign of mercy in the world of light. So-and-so, who's passed away, addresses you from the hidden kingdom as follows. O ye friends of God, be not grieved because of my separation, for I am abiding in a realm wherein all my wishes are realized. Be thou not grieved on account of the departure of thy father, mother and brother, because they became delivered from this world, which is full of sadness and sorrow, and they have hastened to the realm of joy. They have become freed from the fetters of this prison and soared to the divine court. That wanderer, referring to again the death of someone, has ascended to his original abode. thy dear brother has ascended unto the mortal world, from this mortal world to the eternal realm. That drop has hastened to the limitless ocean. Thou shalt find him at the effulgent gathering in the kingdom of mysteries. Over and over he promises this thing. This luminous gathering, spiritual assemblages. Yes? I think that there is that connection. I haven't seen any confirmation in the writings except that our children, you know, we will recognize them in the next world. And it talks about what we owe to our parents who have set us on the journey of eternal existence. Sometimes someone has complained to the guardians and, you know, I don't want to contact my father because isn't this and that. And he would point out these. It's those two souls that have given you existence. Wouldn't have it otherwise. So there's always something due, even if they haven't served us as we think a mother or father should be, or as the world thinks it should be. There is that connection. And I should think that wouldn't be lost at all in the next world. It says that we will recognize our children. Now about the prenatal ones, I don't know, but it's an interesting prospect. Especially when the little ones now grown come and greet with full of love, greet their parents and ask why it was that they aborted them. What caused you to, you know, that's worth thinking a couple of. As to thy dream thou didst have, that thy brother appeared fully dressed, clothed. Clothing is the ornament of man, and that is the bounty of the merciful. As to the bundle he had in his hand, it is his benevolent deeds, and his serious look denoted his purpose to make thee realize the following fact. Consider to what bounty I have attained. Praise be to God that I am safe and well, and have on me the garment of piety, and carry in my hand the bundle of my deeds. I am alive and not dead. Consider closely. I am living and have not passed away. Be thou attentive. Claire Gung was pioneering in Africa when I was visiting in Kenya. She was recovering from a broken limb and was pretty much confined to bed, but she said that she had had several experiences where when she was ill, she thought she'd actually passed away, and she'd be there for a little while and see things of the kingdom, then she'd come back again. And it kind of gives you this very uneasy feeling, like, you know, she started to recount a few of these things, and it puts your hair on end, I mean, not from fright, but just from excitement, that how you just feel that they've seen this. These souls sometimes have seen things. And she talked about the luminous ones that met her and talked with her a little bit, and they had this lovely box, jewel box, and she wanted to see what was in it, and they opened it, and in it was this little ball like mercury, with a little golden mercury ball rolling around in it. And she asked them, what was that? And they said, those are your good deeds. She said, is that all? She said, they seemed pleased enough, but to me it looked like very little to go on. She said, then she kind of just confided, she was quite elderly at this stage, she kind of faded out, you know, and she said, you know, she said, oh, it was wonderful there, she said, because you could walk into the rivers, the most beautiful rivers, and they had the most beautiful things in them, and you didn't need to worry, you just walked down into the water, under the water, and you could walk along the bottom of the rivers and look at everything, and all these scenes are so beautiful. You keep raving about the countryside and the landscapes and all the. Then they said I had to come back. Interesting experiences. I don't know, I guess She came back determined to put something more in it. I think that, you know, I don't know what we can say about that, except I'm sure that the next world is as real for them as it is for the others. You can interpret that the way you want. Baha'u'llah says, you know, that some souls on their death will shake and tremble with fright. And indeed, you see, sometimes you hear about people. If you live in villages, you tend to hear more than you do in cities. In cities, people are shut in their houses and you don't know how they died. In villages, every once in a while, there were a real bad egg would die in Nicaragua, for example. And the whole town would kind of shake. The man who was really almost with palsy, you know, just completely bones and been sick a long time, sleeping on a wooden cot in a little hut, really, that doesn't have any way to keep the sounds in. And at the last, there's a vigil with him. At last, he's dying. He starts to die. And he doesn't want to die. And he jumps up on the bed, you know. He jumps up with strength that is impossible that he could move. And starts shouting and cursing against God and cursing the next world. And everybody trembles. And then finally he just collapses and dies. And it makes everybody very nervous, you know. I mean, he obviously saw something that put him in this state. What was it? So I don't know. Yes, yes, you can understand that very well. So if you're living in hell here, you'll probably have a good taste of it there. How long it will last, we don't know. But it says that heaven and hell are, you know, in every realm of God. Earlier on we were reading those quotations, talks about what the rewards are and what the punishments are. The punishment is to be deprived of that grace. Now you may find that you're just living along just the way you were, and that seems all right, you know. Says that we live in a realm that's the product of our own desires and imagination to some extent. So maybe we won't perceive it as so bad after all. Maybe it will have some element of tolerance, I don't know.
Do you actually accept the idea of
I'm not equipped or prepared to say that we don't, because of all these quotations we have here, where he says that this is the mirror image of that world. Now it's in a much different state here. But all of these concepts, we're told by the Master, are as letters and words revealing the truths about the divine nature. So I should think that these symbols have value at every level. But the question of their density and their, you know, what they're used for and how they're used. Abdu'l Bahá speaks about the teaching trip of one of the Baha'is who was rather corpulent. He'd been off to an area teaching. You remember this thing he talks about? He said he had a dream of him, and he saw him came back to the fruits, and things were so pleasant in that place where he'd been. And the infinite variety of things, I don't think that's probably denied in any sense. Now, if it's denied, it's because there's something so much richer and more interesting than that. But the problem is, if we view the next world and we empty it of landscapes, what do we fill it with? This is the question, you know, that one has here now. Otherwise, you have, if these are the means that they've given us of understanding, if these are the signs and symbols of that, then meditating on them and believing them in that sense, not necessarily like outer physical things, but at least a spiritual counterpart. In dreams, why do you have landscapes in dreams? It's not a physical world. And yet you see all kinds of landscapes. What are they made of? You know, so I don't know if we can say that they're not or they aren't. seems that they'll all have different meanings, perhaps. Yes, they may be all that kind of thing, but there may be also that the words of God in the next world are a river that you bathe in. Who knows? we don't know. You know what will be the meaning of these things? Some people who had dreams of various sorts it feels more natural to the discussion of these things, you know, because they've seen things. But I think dreams are one of the hints to us that it's not going to be a less pictorial world than this one, but the images and vision of that world is infinitely greater than this. But maybe we won't be able to stub our toe on it like we do here, you know. At least only the good part and not the other part. I don't know. Maybe. Spiritual skydiving or something. People have dreams about flying, you know, without airplanes. I mean, just flying. They're interesting kinds of. Saves money that way, yeah. I usually go through and check and choose, but I didn't have time this week, so I'm having to review. You'll excuse me a little bit. I'll just check and see if there are things that are different from the former tablets that I take time with. Beloved, the horrible and awful news of the departure of the daughter of that beloved became the cause of intense grief, because undoubtedly separation has a bitter taste, yet the people of the effulgences are happy by the favors of the beloved of the horizons. This is a rather quaint translation, isn't it? Because the Lord of the Covenant has ordained eternal union and everlasting unity for his friends. Therefore, this temporary separation, although it causes sorrow, yet the infinite nearness and the heavenly union is the comfort of the hearts of the afflicted. Although at present we are separated, confused, in anguish, and helpless, yet in the end we will be his companions, his associates, joining in his melodious song and under his kind shelter. Therefore, thou shouldst not be grieved and saddened. Comfort thyself with the infinite favor and the glad tidings of the heavenly life. Dr. James Carmichael passed to his true home after 3 years suffering with neuritis. While suffering terrible pains, this is an account from Star of the West, he would exclaim with a smile, "Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Baha will take care of me." The Most Great Name always brought relief. The moment he heard of the revelation in May 1899, he accepted and remained a firm believer under the most severe tests. The heavenly light that spread over his face as his soul took upward flight was startling and seen by all. Strangers and friends exclaimed alike, "Oh, see the light!" The following is an extract from a recent tablet received by Mrs. Carmichael in answer to a supplication written by her prior to Dr. Carmichael's passing. She wrote him before he passed away, okay? "Concerning what you have written about your dear husband, be thou not grieved, for praise be to God, he has attained unto everlasting life and has reaped the fruit of his existence on earth. And this is faith and the complete turning of the face toward the kingdom of God. This is verily everlasting health. This is eternal comfort. This is heavenly exaltation. And this is merciful bounty." Indeed, the separation from thy dear husband is very hard and difficult for thee. But he obtained the privilege of beholding the beauty of the Almighty. We and you will also soar to that world, and you will find his shining face visible in the heavenly realm, in the world of the kingdom, and you will find eternal union with him. Yes? Well, I think just what you're saying is kind of the answer. I mean, talking about these things, you're getting interested now. What can you do to assure that you're part of this, so to speak? You know, it prompts us. It awakens us a thirst, even though we can't clearly understand it. It creates in us this other way of looking at life, you know? In other words, our values begin to change. Maybe we say, well, we give more time to prayer, or if this is the life where I have free will to serve, let me serve with my whole being. Do I want to die a rich man with a pain in my stomach on my bed in a nice house? Or do I want to be off somewhere in the jungle or in the mountains teaching a whole nation the cause of God, even if I'm hungry and don't have anything? You know, it's like you start examining, well, what are you going to do with your life? Would I really like to be a martyr? I mean, if we're all going to die anyway, think maybe just go out very quickly. If we had the privilege, the bounty of actually being martyrs. Or does it frighten us? If it frightens us, why? If we could see how we were going to die anyway, in what conditions we would die, how much nuisance we might be to people, who knows? Everybody says, oh, I just pray that I won't be trouble for people, you know, as I'm older and get sick and... That really is a trial, not only for those that take care of the sick people, but from what one understands, the sick people themselves. That is a long martyrdom of not being able to take care of yourself or clean yourself or do anything, waiting on other people. You have your high standard and they don't take care of you the way they should take care of you. And the more you think that way and talk about it, the less they want to take care of you. Nobody wants to see you anymore. And there's nothing to do. You hear the older people crying in that condition. Oh, God, I want to die so bad. What are we doing with our lives? You know? Which way are we faced? I think these are the questions. The same question, you know, you don't have the answer, but you already have an answer in a sense. You were discontent enough to go pioneering, and now you're serving at the World Center. Obviously, something's going on, you know. Why aren't you in the States making a good salary and providing for your future? Getting a second PhD or something. Something, I mean, real, you know. Instead of this kind of iffy religious stuff. This is so touching. This is a tablet of Abdu Bahadur, Mr. Purcell's of Chicago. Now, his wife died here, and Abdu Baha wrote in the news. This was he writes, he says, "O thou whose soul is tranquilized by the grace of God and by the greatest gift, verily I inform thee of that by which thy breast will be dilated with joy, thy heart will rejoice, and thy soul will be delighted in every time and moment. And it is this, that verily thy honored wife, who journeyed unto God and hastened unto the blessed spot, her heart ignited with the fire of the love of God, and her sight and gaze extended toward the kingdom of El Abha, was firm in the testament, and was overtaken by death in the land of Beirut, and is now attracted to the living one who shall never die. Verily she surrendered her life while she was in a condition wherein she was encompassed with the glad tidings of thy Lord from all directions, and her nostrils were perfumed with the fragrances of holiness from the Supreme Concourse. Her soul soared to the summit of sanctity, under the shelter of the mercy of thy Lord, where the concourse of the chosen ones are assembled around it in the lofty paradise, and the angels of mercy are blessing it and are speaking its praise, while their faces are smiling because of her ascension to heaven. By the life of God, wert thou informed of her prosperity and of the bounty with which she is surrounded, and of the favors of thy Lord, which were her greatest desire, thou wouldst smile with joy, and thy breast would be dilated, and thou wouldst thank God for that which he hath poured upon her, that he hath adorned her with the embroidery of sanctity and purity in his the all-glorious, and that he hath crowned her with the diadem of the greatest gift in the Supreme Concourse." It's quite an obituary notice, isn't it? Amazing. One day in 1940, I understand that at the pilgrim table, Shoghi Effendi was speaking about life after death and described this, what happens to the souls with the friends. Riya Khanum was there. And he built this up till they were really looking at the other world, what he was, the way he was describing it, and the way the souls are greeted and rush forth with chalices of light and all these things. So finally, Riya Khanum was so excited and is said to have, I've never asked her directly about this because I didn't want to ask her indirectly, that said that she said to Shoghi Effendi that, "Oh, how I'd love to be there and see that." And he turned to her with his face full of light and he said to her, "Your mother has attained to that blessing." And that was how she heard of her mother's passing from him, and after telling him such a story. And then, of course, he consoled her. And she mentioned something of this in Buenos Aires when she was at her mother's graveside. The first time that she visited, we were honored to be present on that occasion with her and some of the friends. And she said that that in the other world, that your mother is going around and telling everybody all the time about her wonderful daughter, what a wonderful daughter she has, and how she's serving the cause. And she's just a wonder. And says, and they're all patiently listening. But he said, if she doesn't stop this after a while, they're going to send her back. Then he said one day to her, he said, your mother, May Maxwell, you know, was Herr Farnum's mother. He said, May Maxwell, he says, is the pump of God that pumpeth on high. And she's pumping light and love. She's attained to these supreme favors. There's some beautiful cables that were sent particularly to Persia, about where he was much more open about the nature of the other world than in his cables to the West. And he talks about this scene when Martha Root ascended, and how the inmates of the all highest paradise, she ascended immediately to the supreme apex when she passed away. He said, and these souls rushed out of their habitations to witness her and to greet her, and again to offer these chalices and drink with healthy relish, oh maidservant, for you have passed the entire distance, or something like this nature, you know, describing what she had achieved. And when May Maxwell passed away, it was a similar kind of a thing. Well done, O maidservant of God. All the denizens of the Supreme Concourse coming out to circling around and greeting the soul as it arrives in the other world. Sounds nice, doesn't it? Now, those are the souls that gave everything, you know. They just gave everything here, and they get everything there. Now, we want to be comfortable and we want our rewards in this life, or shall we save them up, cash them in? You know, it's like bonds. You can put it in the bank or you can spend it all. You spend it all, well, you don't have anything to spend later. I think you have to think of your families and your loved ones, but hopefully your families, our families and our loved ones will all be interested in throwing themselves into the service and sacrifice of the faith. But one has to balance. There's still a balance there. But the understanding is greater, if we're here and if we have five spouses. There's always that problem. We want to go pioneering and we have two small children. Will they get better education? Will they be happier if they live here? Certainly not going to be happy living on that desert island where there's nothing to eat. So we should probably not go pioneering then, for their sake. Shoghi Effendi said the children share in the rewards of the parents who pioneer. Even though their children don't always acknowledge that, and some of them even complain about how their lives were wrecked by their Baha'i parents. It's a curious kind of thing, but I think that, in that case then Baha'u'llah shouldn't have declared his mission, because it's going to be a problem for his family. It really was a problem for his family, wasn't it? Where you really think about it a little bit. Either we have to do what we have to do, or we don't. But moderation still has to play in there, and depending on there's different phases in our lives, and there's different accelerations in service, and there's a rhythm sometimes, there's a counterbalancing, because one also has to rest and has to recover, and one shouldn't push to the point where you become ill, or where you become imbalanced in your mind. It's possible to, force things too much in a fanatic way. One should carry sacrifice and service lightly. It shouldn't be ponderous and heavy. It also shouldn't go inside and puff us up. Another thing. Yeah. Yes. And in service of the faith, in pioneering and teaching the cause, in any kind of service, one has to take into consideration the wishes of a spouse. And unless there's unity in the matter, then the one that's overeager, that appears that way, has to pull back. There has to be a balance.
I'm reading some early Baha'i in the West, and I was really struck last night by the account of how to close the eyes. He became a Baha'i, hid his wife's abusive children. She had really sacrificed to help him become a unified Christian. And he resigned his position in the church and took his job as a traveling salesman. And they became poor. And his wife became head of the church. And in the next sentence, and we hear about these tablets that Abdul Baha'i kept sending him, praising him for making this choice to be a family salesman because it allowed him to serve the cause. And these two things are side by side. The wife was slowly going mad. And they did actually end up divorcing. And Abdul Baha'i prayed. It could be. I mean, obviously, you have to look at your situation individually, but in this instance, a man was getting counsel to go for it.
There's all the encouragement from the side of the writings. But again, one has to see what the situation is. And not all the situations are everlasting. I mean, there are phases where one thing may be more appropriate than another. And actually, we're going to pray to try to know what's the right thing in every situation. But he who serves most is nearest to God, Abdul Baha says. And being near to God is a great blessing for the people around us. It shouldn't be a test. I mean, it should help us to more effectively communicate and express love and draw closer to our loved ones, rather than to separate us from them. If it's the right thing, I should think that, you know, one would want to see that it does that. It's like we were saying last week, you know, maybe it was with the new arrivals, we were talking about this, how, you know, we work so hard that we're tired all the time, and the tireder we get, the more privilege we think we should have, because we're so tired in service that we can afford to be a little critical of the ones that don't do so much, and a little impatient with the ones that are off playing all the time, when we real Baha'is are working very hard. And gradually, you know, you undermine the whole basis of the service as a kind of something to distinguish us from others. What we're trying to do is distinguish ourselves from our lower selves, not from anybody else. You know, trying to. We don't know what our capacity is. We don't know how we will be judged. We will be judged on what we do with what we've got. And if we've got a lot, and we don't all know because we haven't tested it out, and we only do a little, we won't be very well off. Somebody else who had very little but did everything they could with it, they'll be very well off. So we want to see, we're only judged against what we've been given and what we do with it. About Howard Colby Ives, later on he had a very spiritual helpmate. And they traveled together, and after a while they couldn't do travel salesman work. And they used to go and open towns for the faith, stay a while to teach. And they'd oftentimes get a job washing dishes. The two of them would wash dishes in a restaurant. They liked that job because it was out of sight. And they could work hard for long periods and then be able to rent a hotel room where they could greet the friends and meet their contacts and so on and do the teaching work. And they did that. I mean, this man was an educated man. He'd been the head of a large church and so on, and he spent a whole middle period of his life doing very menial labor so as to be able to teach the cause in these places. And then gradually his powers started failing. He had a nervous affliction which gave him pain in his body, a lot of pain, till finally it paralyzed much of him. He went blind so that he couldn't do the study of the cause which he loved so much. I've seen some letters that he wrote to some of the believers that he taught. It was marvelous counsel about how to study the writings and how one should apply themselves in reading the verses and how one should acquire thirst for reading the verses and how you should start off and give yourself a fair start at the beginning, you know, maybe start, he said, with 2 hours of reading of the holy writings a day and then gradually build up. He said, don't start too much. And he said that he took take his books on the trains that they traveled on, you know, and he kept notebooks on different subjects, and he would constantly read and reread the writings, he said, and this is an ocean that we should, same as Baha'u'llah says, we should immerse ourselves in. And his wife, seeing his condition in the last years, the last months and weeks of his life, was really feeling desperate about how much pain he had, and she finally, under the influence of seeing him in such intense suffering, went to another room and poured her heart out to Abdu'l-Bahá and said, oh Abdu'l-Bahá, take him. How can he keep suffering like this? I can't bear to see it. Can't you take him? And then she prayed and prayed until she became calm. Then she went back in to see Howard. And when Howard realized she was there, he said to her, Mabel, he said, the most wonderful thing has happened. The Master came. And he told me that if I wished, I could go. But then he said that if I chose to linger a little longer, it would be better. Because he was preparing me to become a teacher in the University of the Kingdom. So he said, I said I'd stay a bit longer. Well, he was a wonderful spiritual teacher. These are again similar tablets, all on the same subject. Replying to another questioner, Abdu'l-Bahá said that when two people, husband and wife for instance, have been completely united in this life, their souls being as one soul, then after one of them had passed away, this union of heart and soul would remain unbroken. Then the Master said to another person, if you could see the glory in which your mother now dwells, you would not care to live another day. You could not live if you could see. Words of Abdu'l-Bahá, Flowers Culled from the Rose Garden of Akka, page 16. You heard of that one? This is a letter of the Guardian written on behalf of the Guardian. We should remember the promises we are given of the world to come. And picturing to ourselves the greater spiritual development the departed ones obtain, comfort ourselves and patiently await our reunion there. Another letter. In his tablets, Baha'u'llah says that were we able to comprehend the felicities that await us in the world to come, death would lose its sting. Nay, rather, we would welcome it as a gateway to a realm immeasurably higher and nobler than this home of suffering we call our earth. You should therefore think of their blessings and comfort yourself for your momentary separation. In time, all of us will join our departed ones and share their joys. Baha'u'llah says that were we to have the proper vision to see the blessings of the other world, We would not bear to endure one more hour of existence upon the earth. The reason why we're deprived of that vision is because otherwise no one would care to remain and the whole fabric of society will be destroyed. Shoghi Effendi wishes you, therefore, to think of her blessings and rejoice in her happiness. Should we have true faith in the words of the prophets, we would not fear death nor feel despondent over the passing of our loved ones. Such earnest souls, when they pass out of this life, enter a state of being far nobler and more beautiful than this one. We fear it only because it is unknown to us, and we have little faith in the words of the prophets who bring a true message of certainty from that realm of the spirit. We should face death with joy, especially if our life upon this plane of existence has been full of good deeds. The mercy of God is infinite. If He promises us He is the All-Merciful, why should we ever fear for the condition of a loyal and true believer when he goes to receive in the next world the outpourings of His mercy? Well, next week we'll take up some more of these very penetrating themes.